occupation forces resumed their offensive against Gaza on March 18th, breaking a two-month ceasefire. Nearly 1,070 civilians have been killed since then. The death toll from the regime's genocide now tops 50,400, with over 114,600 others injured. Joining us now from Khan Yunis in the south of Gaza's very own Ahmad al-Najjar. Ahmad, what updates do you have to share with us as this Israeli genocidal massacre continues all across Gaza?
Party, it's been more than 3 days now since the Israeli announced their expansion of the military operations within the Rafah, all over Rafah city, and in addition to the southern part of Khan Yunis city, which forced tens of thousands of families to be forced into displacement. Families were lucky enough to find a place to stay in. However, this is not the situation for other thousands of families who had to stay in their homes and could not evacuate it because they had no other place and to go to. They know that where they are, where they will head to, is nothing more but desert, where there are no sources for humanitarian services or adequate shelters, as the occupation has been preventing their entry on all humanitarian needs, including the urgent means of sheltering. In Rafah city and Khan Yunis, the northern outskirts of Rafah and the southern ones of Khan Yunis, over the past 12 hours, at least four massacres were committed against the families. This morning, we received the news of the killing of one of my cousins and her family within the Al-Manara neighborhood in southeastern Khan Yunis. She was killed with her husband and three children. Her third children just succumbed to his wounds about 2 hours ago. In addition to that, another family of Shurab family within the Ma'an neighborhood in eastern Khan Yunis, two homes of Shurab families were also targeted by Israeli warplanes over the night, killing about 15 other members of the family, including two children as well. The families were buried under the rubble, and it was until the late night hours that the local families and civil defense crew managed to dig them and extract them out. But the situation is escalating and deteriorating tragically for the families here because the occupation announced the intention of expanding and taking control of what they call the Miraj Corridor. It's almost the parallel one to the Netzarim Corridor, only that it separates between Khan Yunis and Rafah city, to continue the scenario of slicing the Gaza Strip and ensure the continued control and continued blockade upon the families and emptying the families from their town to annex more of the Palestinian land here. But these attacks, these atrocities against the Palestinians were not limited on the southern Gaza Strip, but also in the northern parts of the Gaza Strip, the occupation seems to become more innovative in killing the families there within Ash-Shuja'iyya neighborhood, where an entire block, a residential block, was bombed over the night by an Israeli detonating robot that was planted within that neighborhood.
Thanks a lot, Ahmad al-Najjar, joining us from Khan Yunis in the south of Gaza. Displaced Palestinians mourn the loss of their loved ones after an Israeli airstrike on a UN building in Jabalia left 22 people dead, including women and children. They say the attack came without any warning and no place is safe from Israeli strikes.
There is absolutely no security here. They dropped a missile from the right side and another from the left side. Without warning, they dropped the two missiles without any prior warning. My mom was cooking on fire over there. A child was playing with a scooter in the alleyway. Some people were exiting the toilet. Others were cooking, people who are totally uninvolved, who have done absolutely nothing against the Israelis. They ended up being bombarded, massacred, left without heads or legs.
This is a clinic housing young children. It's affiliated with the UN, not Hamas or Fatah. As you can see, the martyrs are young children. They're all young boys and girls. In what way do they have the right to kill them? Targeting the clinic itself, not even outside, hitting the classroom over their heads. Where is the United Nations and where is the world?
What are these crimes of the occupation? What are these crimes? Show it to the entire world. Show it to all of humanity in the world, in the east and west of the earth.
The UN Human Rights Council has passed a resolution condemning Israel's renewed onslaught on Gaza. The council also demanded the regime prevent genocide and lift its illegal blockade on the territory. The resolution, which was put forward by most members of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, was adopted with an overwhelming majority. It voiced grave concern at statements by Israeli officials that amount to incitement to genocide. The resolution demanded unimpeded humanitarian aid and the restoration of basic necessities in Gaza. It also slammed the use of starvation of civilians as a weapon of war. The resolution called on all nations to halt arms sales to Israel and take immediate action to prevent the forcible transfer of Palestinians from Gaza. The text also called on the UN General Assembly to set up a new investigative team to prepare prosecutions for major international crimes committed in the war on Gaza. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has begun his four-day trip to Hungary, defying an international criminal court arrest warrant over his war crimes in Gaza. Netanyahu was welcomed by his Hungarian counterpart Viktor Orban in Budapest in an official ceremony. His arrival comes despite the ICC criticizing Hungary for ignoring its legal obligation to detain him. Orban's invitation has sparked outrage from human rights groups, calling it a cynical attempt to undermine the ICC. Hungary, as a signatory to the Rome Statute, is legally bound to comply with ICC rulings. The warrant issued against Netanyahu last year alleges that he and his former Minister of Military Affairs are guilty of crimes against humanity for depriving Palestinians in the Gaza Strip of food, aid, and deliberately targeting civilians. Palestinian scientist and author Mazen Ghamsia says Hungary has violated the international law for accommodating a war criminal.
The leaders of Hungary are really in line in their thinking, anti-Islamic, anti-human rights from the beginning. Of course, as you mentioned, this doesn't abrogate their legal right under international law. So they signed the convention, so they're obligated to obey the convention. So you are violating your own laws to accommodate a fellow right-wing fascist, basically, Netanyahu, who's committing war crimes and crimes against humanity. Accountability starts with the people getting on their government, so the Hungarian people, whom I have a lot of respect for, I have friends in Hungary, that they have the responsibility to rise up. And the same with the U.S. and many other countries. It's time for them to rise up.
The Yemeni armed forces have shot down another advanced U.S. drone as it was violating the country's airspace.
The Yemeni armed forces' air defenses, with the help of Allah Almighty, were able to shoot down an American MQ-9 drone while it was carrying out hostile missions in the airspace of Hudaydah Governorate. The drone was downed with a locally made surface-to-air missile. This is the second our air defenses have shot down in 72 hours and the 17th during the Battle of the Promised Victory and the Holy Jihad in support of Gaza.
Yahya Sarei said the Yemeni military has also targeted the U.S. aircraft carrier USS Harry Truman and other warships in the Red Sea with cruise missiles and drones. He said the operation achieved its objectives. Sarei said the Yemeni army's operations will continue until the regime's genocide against the oppressed Palestinian people in Gaza stops and the siege of the territory is lifted. He added that U.S. warplanes launched 36 overnight airstrikes on different parts of Yemen, including Sana'a, Sa'ada, and Hodeidah, leaving a number of people dead and injured. Syrian Foreign Ministry condemns in the strongest terms the latest wave of Israeli attacks on the Arab country. The ministry called on the international community, including the UN, to pressure the regime to halt its aggression. The statement said the attacks are a violation of Syrian sovereignty and part of Israel's attempt to normalize violence against Damascus. This came after Israel carried out airstrikes targeting a defense research center in northern Damascus, as well as military airports in Hama and Homs provinces. Over a dozen people were killed in the attack. Simultaneously with the air raids, Israel's military vehicles started advancing in the Dara countryside, pounding the area with artillery fire, leaving 9 people dead. Residents took up arms and clashed with Israeli forces after mosques in Dara called for a general mobilization. President Donald Trump has imposed sweeping new tariffs on U.S. trading partners, a move that the European Union has labeled as a major blow to the world economy.
President Trump's announcement of universal tariffs on the whole world, including the European Union, is a major blow to the world economy. I deeply regret this choice. Let's be clear-eyed about the immense consequences. The global economy will massively suffer. Uncertainty will spiral and trigger the rise of further protectionism. The consequences will be dire for millions of people around the globe, also for the most vulnerable countries, which are now subject to some of the highest U.S. tariffs, the opposite of what we wanted to achieve.
The EU chief also said the bloc was prepared for further countermeasures to protect its interests and businesses if negotiations failed. Ursula von der Leyen emphasized that there's still an opportunity to address concerns through dialogue. China also expressed firm opposition to the tariffs on its exports, pledging to take countermeasures. Beijing also criticized the measures as non-compliant with international trade rules that harm the legitimate rights and interests of the affected parties. Colombia and Australia criticized the U.S. for imposing new tariffs as well, vowing to take measures to protect their industries.
The administration's tariffs have no basis in logic, and they go against the basis of our two nations' partnership. This is not the act of a friend. Today's decision will add to uncertainty in the global economy, and it will push up costs for American households. It is the American people who will pay the biggest price for these unjustified tariffs.
At this moment, together with the Ministry of Commerce, the Ministry of Agriculture, and the other sectors, we are evaluating the measures to be put in place, mainly to protect our national industry and our exports. We will work hand in hand with the private sector and with every sector to review what measures we will consider and implement based on this decision of the United States.
Brazil also responded to the U.S. tariffs by passing a legislation called the Economic Reciprocity Law, granting the executive authority to address trade barriers. Japan also criticized the U.S., calling the imposition of new levies extremely regrettable. The reactions followed President Donald Trump's announcement of new tariffs, including a 34% levy on imports from China, 20% on European Union imports, and a baseline 10% tariff on goods from numerous other nations.
For decades, the United States has pushed and even compelled nations to lower their tariffs, but returning President Donald Trump has unveiled a minimum 10% tariff on the entire world. Dozens of countries with the largest trade imbalances will now face tariffs of up to 50%, with China at 34% and the European Union at 20%. Trump has termed the shattering of the post-World War II framework of Western-led economic relations Liberation Day.
Well, in the coming days, there will be complaints from the globalists and the outsourcers and special interests and the fake news. Always, the fake news will always complain. But never forget, every prediction our opponents made about trade for the last 30 years has been proven totally wrong. They were wrong about NAFTA. They were wrong about China.
A negative economic impact has already been felt from Indonesia to Wall Street, and many believe economic and geopolitical breakdown is only just beginning. While the United States has some of the lowest tariffs in the West, and while many countries employ tariffs to protect their economy, many see the tariff trade war as another part of Trump's openly expansionist and belligerent agenda.
Tariffs usually need years to bear fruit, meaning that the average American consumer will likely face higher prices even amid years of record inflation. Polls show that nearly 60% of the country believes that the tariffs will increase costs.
The tariffs are larger than many had expected, and analysts say the developing world is being treated especially harshly. No one is really sure what will come next. The worst-case scenario is a global trade war and a global recession, while a best-case scenario seems to at least include worsen global opinion about the United States. Ramin Mazahari, Washington, D.C.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio, for those who seek the truth.
In the limelight.
Even as independent evidence of Israeli regime crimes continues to mount, Western nations are content to consume anti-Palestinian propaganda. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, earlier this month, a special United Nations commission issued a report documenting Israel's systematic use of sexual, reproductive, and gender-based violence in the occupied Palestinian territories since October 7, 2023. This comes as the Zionist regime has renewed its all-out war on Gaza after a few weeks of calm, the first phase of a now-discarded ceasefire agreement. The deal was meant to permanently end the violence, complete the exchange of Israeli and Palestinian captives, and oversee the Zionist regime's withdrawal from Gaza. It has now been derailed. Crimes involving sexual violence have been just one part of Israel's genocide in Gaza, which has killed tens of thousands of people and decimated more than 80% of the territory's buildings. A few days before the UN report came out, we watched the American documentary October 8, which cited the baseless allegations that the resistance movement Hamas committed sexual violence during its 2023 Al-Aqsa Storm operation. The film, which focuses primarily on anti-Semitism on U.S. college campuses in the ensuing months, is undisguised propaganda. It endorses the Zionist regime's goal of exterminating Hamas, including through combat tactics that are widely seen as genocidal, targeting Gaza's entire civilian population. Yet, there is no equivalence in the scope of the allegations of sexual violence by the two warring sides, nor in their documentation. October 8 references the events of a single day, while the United Nations Commission covers the entire period since then. The first relies on largely unsubstantiated Israeli accusations, while the second stems from a diligent and objective evidence-gathering process that was largely ignored in the West. Indeed, access to information about Israeli criminality is filtered in the West by systematic self-censorship, undoubtedly induced, at least indirectly, by the broadly pro-Israel allegiances of Western governments. While October 8 was shown in 100 theaters across the U.S., despite being undisguised state propaganda, the more artistically motivated and dramatically enacted No Other Land was denied distribution in the country, even though it won an Oscar, the industry's highest acclaim. The bias extends to the television and print platforms, which is why the Western media took little notice of the UN's reliably documented account of the systematic sexual abuse of Palestinian detainees, while according to prominence, to unverified accounts of the mistreatment of Israeli hostages. These double standards in public discourse are often fueled by Western political leaders who parrot Israeli state propaganda and enforce strict curbs on pro-Palestinian expression and protest. This biased atmosphere helps us to understand why there is such a knowledge and awareness gap when it comes to Israeli regime criminality. Under international law, the Zionist regime is an occupying power, and as such, it is obliged by the Fourth Geneva Convention to protect the civilian population under its control. The convention stipulates that civilians shall in all circumstances be treated humanely without any adverse distinction founded on race, color, religion or faith, sex, birth or wealth, or any similar criteria. It specifically prohibits sexual violence and mass forcible transfers of an occupied population. The Zionist regime's mistreatment of Palestinians in the occupied territories stands in flagrant disregard of these intentional legal obligations. In Gaza, the Zionist regime's principal goal is to terrorize Palestinians, pushing them to leave their homes or face near certain death. The Zionist regime's motives are no longer couched in the language of security, but are now openly territorial. From the outset of its occupation of Gaza and the West Bank in 1967, the Israeli regime has defied international humanitarian law in numerous ways. This was amply documented in a near-unanimous advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice in July 2024, which addressed only the pre-October 7 violations. Significantly, the ICJ concluded that Israel has so fundamentally violated the Geneva Conventions that its occupation is thus unlawful, putting the UN and member states under an obligation to act accordingly. As the Zionist regime's genocidal assault on Gaza has continued month after month, the United Nations has noted a deliberate effort by the state to target Palestinian civilians. This has been exhibited through Israel's frequent bombing of residential structures and neighborhoods, and its reliance on high-yield explosives, making it difficult for civilians to seek refuge. These combat patterns have led to a disproportionate number of women and children dying. On the ground, Israeli regime forces are given carte blanche to carry out sadistic abuses of men and women, including prolonged and abusive strip searching, coercive interrogation, torture, and a variety of humiliating and harassing practices that enjoy tacit government approval. The Zionist regime's toleration of sexual violence against Palestinians, as described in this month's UN report, has been shocking, with top officials either dismissing such allegations as anti-Semitism or suggesting the abuse was justifiable retribution for the October 7th Al-Aqsa Storm operation. The UN report notes the statements and actions by political and civic leaders and the lack of effectiveness of the military judicial system send a clear message to Israeli forces that they can continue committing such acts without fear of accountability. This report makes a convincing case that sexual violence has been not only tolerated, but encouraged by top Israeli regime officials. This dehumanization of the Palestinian people is closely linked with Israel's overt plan to forcibly transfer Gaza's civilian population, not for reasons of security, but to fulfill the Zionist mission of clearing the way for the establishment of Greater Israel as a Jewish supremacist state.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Good evening. 46 years ago, one of the fastest and most comprehensive processes of power transfer in history was determined through the ballot box. The decisive development was a crystallization of the historic determination and desire of the Iranians to consolidate the foundations of independence, dignity, and national sovereignty. In a landmark referendum held in 1979, more than 98.2% of all eligible voters said yes to the establishing and an Islamic Republic in Iran. The vote held less than 2 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution is considered as a turning point in the modern history of Iran. On this national day, we stand at a pivotal juncture to critically examine the achievements and challenges of the Islamic Republic of Iran. In a world fraught with adversity, this system has endured decades of turbulence, persisting through foreign-backed conspiracies, economic pressures, and constant threats of military action. Yet its survival raises essential questions about resilience, progress, and the price of independence. I am Bahman Nouri, your host, and in this spotlight, we go over the history of the Islamic Republic and the ups and downs it has gone through. Let us begin with a short report.
The Islamic Republic of Iran. Three words that mark one of the most significant milestones in the country's history. Islamic Republic Day, celebrated on April the 1st, commemorates the referendum that established this new governing system, ushering in a new era, endorsed by 98.2% of the voters, as defined by its late founder Imam Khomeini. Islamic Republic, not a word more, not a word less. 46 years later, the sentiments remain just as strong.
The overwhelming presence of people at public celebrations, rallies, and events is a clear sign of the strong support for the Islamic Republic.
We voted for the Islamic Republic after the revolution because it was our slogan, independence, freedom, and Islamic Republic. This choice aligned perfectly with our ideals and aspirations.
Islamic Republic Day embodies one of the key slogans of the 1979 revolution chanted by masses, independence, freedom, and Islamic Republic. And today, a new generation remains committed to honoring this legacy, preserving the values that have shaped the nation's identity.
I was born after the revolution in the 1980s, and I believe that for us, it brought positive change. I will always stand by and support the Islamic Republic.
The Islamic Republic is the legacy handed down to us by our fathers. It is our duty to honor and protect this legacy so that it may be passed on to future generations.
The establishment of the Islamic Republic did not come easily. Many martyrs sacrificed their lives for us to have it, and it is our responsibility to safeguard it.
But Islamic Republic Day is more than just a national celebration. It highlights Iran's role as a beacon of hope for oppressed nations around the world.
The Islamic Republic is not merely a political system. It is a school of thought and a dialogue with the primary goal of creating justice. Its foundation lies in supporting oppressed people, above all the Palestinian people.
This is why the day serves as a reminder to Iranians of unity and solidarity that extends far beyond the nation's borders.
Iranians are marking the anniversary of the Islamic Republic with national pride, reaffirming their commitment to regional peace and progress towards a brighter future. Gizem Shahmadi, Tehran.
The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back. Allow me to introduce my guests. Saad Shahab, author and commentator, joining us from Belfast, UK. And John Stepling, author and commentator, joining us from Inderøy, Norway. Gentlemen, very good to have you on the program. I'm going to start with Saab with the first question. 46 years of the Islamic Revolution, and despite all the conspiracies, all the attacks, all the sanctions, it has survived. What do you think is the key to the survival of the Islamic Republic of Iran?
Hello to you and your guests and your audience. The Islamic Revolution of Iran, it wasn't just a regional event. It was a global, and it was a huge global earthquake at the time that resulted in enormous geopolitical shift in the region. It's still shaping and influencing West Asia today and all the Arabic and Islamic world as well. The impact that revolution have in Western imperialist forces, it weakened them since they lost the control of the Shah, who were deploying the huge country of Iran to the service of the imperialists, and to be looted by the Zionist entity and by the Western forces as well. So while this Islamic revolution was straight away when it's broke, erupted in Iran, it's empowered the Islamic and the Arabic world. It's brought about what we call today the Islamic awakening, which is still that thing influencing and shaping the countries in the region and the movements worldwide. So, but it came, the Islamic Revolution as well, let me just allude to this. It came in a very important and a precise point in history, which we witnessed neutralizing of a major power in the region, like Egypt at the time, after signing the Camp David protocols between Sadat of Egypt and the Zionist entity fascist head at the time called Begin. That signature removed Egypt totally from the camp at the time you stand against Zionism and colonialism and placed it under the American domination. And that resulted immensely in strengthening the Zionist entity and provided with political recognition from the largest Arabic and Islamic state in the region. So it gave them free carte blanche on Palestine and to attack the resistance in Lebanon and in Syria. So the eruption of the Islamic Revolution, it changed that. It tilted the balance of power back to the people in the region. That is one of the major points which denied the Americans a free hand in the region and start forming what we have today, the axis of resistance.
Right. I'm going to talk to John right now. John, why do you think the Islamic revolutions, this cause, has survived so many years, so many decades, and can still stand up to the dialogue offered by the West?
I think its durability is rather remarkable, actually. Certainly, the United States and Israel, which is an organ of the United States, essentially, has never made any bones about wanting to bring the downfall of the Republic. And you have to remember that the Shah of Iran was a U.S. puppet. He was installed by the U.S. and the CIA, and the British helped. He had the most notorious secret police probably in the whole of the 20th century, trained by the United States. The U.S. gave him what intelligence it had, and they were very happy because he did what he was told. There was a lot of sort of theatrical visits to differing countries, but Pahlavi simply listened to what the U.S. said. He knew what he was supposed to say. He knew what his policies were supposed to be. And this was a typical CIA playbook kind of a coup that they orchestrated, getting Mossadegh out, putting in the Shah. They've done very similar things, a dozen other places. What is interesting is that when the revolution came, the United States had no intelligence about it at all. They did not expect anything. They did not see it coming. And this has been one of the reasons, I think, that the political class in the U.S. harbor such animosity towards Iran, is they were made to look very foolish. And it was just a massive failure, an intelligence failure. So there's that history looming over everything. And of course, the other reason is that every other country in the region has been subjected to some kind of U.S. incursion, some kind of conflict. And certainly Iran has participated in conflicts too, not particularly willingly, but every country that surrounds Iran has had problems. The U.S. has military bases surrounding the country. Iran is surrounded by U.S. military, and yet they have survived. And not only that, they have a reputation for an extraordinarily adept diplomatic corps, an extremely smart and savvy sort of deep state. It's renowned for this. So they have the respect of all their neighbors. And I think that the few times that Iran has tried to reach out to the U.S., the JCPOA and things like that have ended badly because the U.S. doesn't keep its word, and I hope the current administration in Iran has learned that lesson. And the other point is, since the revolution, Israel has wanted nothing more than a war with Iran. That's been clear.
Right, Saeb, John mentioned something very important, the military bases of the United States around the country, and at the same time, the failure of the last time the two countries started to have some sort of dialogue. We've had throughout the history of the Islamic Republic, we've had all sorts of conspiracies against the Iran. We've had, like, even Saddam Hussein invaded the country and with the support, full support and backing of the Western bloc. They even gave him chemical warfare against the country. And all of these terrors and assassinations by the Israeli regime in Iran, nuclear scientists were assassinated. You know, why all sorts of obstruction, why all sorts of aggression against the country that came with the slogan of peace?
As I said, the Islamic Revolution of Iran, it wasn't just regional. Some people misunderstand it. Some people think it's just a regional country who have a massive revolution. This is have three side effects for it. There's a global, and there is regional, and there is local to Iran. The global became of this influence of the Islamic revolution. It's in power shifting and power distribution. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, it was felt very well. The United States of America have a free ride to control and loot the resources of the whole world and enslaved many countries and fought any countries, even who were close to the Soviet Union. At the time, we noticed even the Russians themselves, the Chinese, become dominated by the unipolar power, the United States of America. West Europe, today, they just discovered they were totally being occupied and controlled by United States of America after the Americans throw them under the bus when they were negotiating with the Russians about the Ukraine. So this is one of the global and start in regional building its own resistance camp facing the United States of America. You mentioned the massive war which they supported Saddam Hussein in launching on Iraq. So they didn't want to leave Iran 1 minute to breathe and to develop itself. They kept the wars on it. They kept the sabotage operations against the scientists. They wanted to disrupt all the development and the sciences advancement in Iran. The whole forces in the world, when they see in Iran, this is advancing and facing that monsters of imperialism, they started themselves to have shaping. You know what we have today is regional powers, and it's developed to some alliance, which today we have the BRICS. This is during the hegemons of the United States of America on world affairs, this wasn't even dreamt with. But the resistance, which is Iran, showed them an example, encouraged a lot of countries to start and to break away and to form their own multipolar system in the world, which we see today with the BRICS, we see with the Chinese, we see with the Russians, we see with South Africa, with Iran. And the right. Islamic revolution in the local level brought to the people of Iran dignity, as you mentioned in your report, sovereignty, independence, and freedom from the criminal white supremacist colonial domination that looted the country during the Shah.
Exactly. You mentioned the key point of independence. If it was one of the key principles of Ayatollah Khomeini's vision for the future of the Islamic Republic. My question for you, John, is how do you think this independence played such a key part in the formation of the state and in redefining the relations the country had with the world?
Well, the United States expects other countries to be obedient, to listen to what the message from Washington is, and to follow the lead of Western diplomats when they visit. This is just expected. And those times when countries show resolve and independence, the United States is shocked. They're angry. They're appalled. They feel they have to discipline this delinquent child in their eyes, and Iran has simply never allowed itself to be pushed around at all. And again, this speaks to the respect that it has from its neighbors. It may not even be liked by many of them, but everybody respects Iran, and they have earned that respect. The U.S. is flailing at the moment. The Trump administration doesn't quite know what to do. He's threatening everybody. If it's not tariffs, it's bombs. And he's got some super hawks in his administration right now who, before the election, Pete Hegseth and Rubio and all these people had said they absolutely want to bomb Iran. The first thing I'm going to do is bomb Iran. Then, of course, when they are, talk with the Pentagon, they talk with the Joint Chiefs, they talk with advisors, and they realize, oh, well, this would be a very bad idea. This is not a simple, tiny little country that we can push around. And in fact, I think given how thinly stretched the U.S. is, they simply can't. They can't engage in another confrontation with anybody. But this returns me to Israel again. Israel, the Greater Israel Project, the expansion, we see it with Syria and Lebanon right now. Netanyahu in particular has always wanted a war with Iran. He has pushed for it relentlessly for 30 years, and he hasn't gotten it. And the reason he hasn't gotten it is that there are a few sane heads in Washington and at the Pentagon who know very well it's simply an impossible thing to do. The U.S. can't even stop the Houthis from shutting down the Red Sea. So I think that Iran has demonstrated a kind of integrity and independence in the face of a lot of provocation. Assassinations of key figures and so forth, and they have remained extremely level-headed and with great resolve, and that's all you can expect, I suppose.
Right, as John mentioned the issue of Israel, I want to talk to Saib about one of the biggest accomplishments of Ayatollah Khomeini in shaping the foreign policy of Iran in the beginning of the new government and in the new structure in Iran. And that was the issue of Palestine. He put the issue of Palestine on top of Iran's foreign policy agenda. How do you think, many experts and analysts are saying that this helped bring the issue of Palestine from being a rather limited regional Arab problem and issue to something global, and the world was kind of awakened to it. What's your take on that?
It's a good question. The first thing, when you notice after the Islamic revolution of Iran, it's felt in the streets of Palestine, a copycat of the Islamic revolution in forms of the resistance, from appearing, first of all, the Islamic wings of the Palestinian revolution, from Islamic Jihad, then later on to Hamas, was formed. The guidance of that was the Islamic revolution of Iran. Then the habits of the Palestinian people start to adjust itself socially, culturally, with the Islamic revolution of Iran. This is important. And the resilience developed in there. Since I mentioned after neutralizing Egypt, Israel got a carte blanche attacking Lebanon, occupied it in 1982, destroying the Palestinian presence in Lebanon, attacking the Lebanese resistance, American landing in Lebanon as victorious with the French forces. Even the resistance was start developing in 1983, attacked them and pushed them back. In the year 2000, the resistance, which were supported by the Islamic Revolution of Iran, managed with the leadership of Hezbollah at the time to cleanse Lebanon from this occupation. And this is at the global level, as I said. You have countries like Venezuela, when it was besieged and blockaded by the United States of America, its neighbor. The Iranian Revolution sent ships of some oil and gas, liquid gas, and the food and supplies, medical supplies, and technologies to support the people who has been oppressed by the Americans. This is felt there is a network of resistance was forming from the transatlantic to the Indian Ocean, Pacific Ocean. And thus, Iran gave an example to a lot of countries to stand in its position facing the Americans. Unipolar kind of act in the world and domination in the world. And the Islamic Revolution set that example, and lots of countries start to follow suit. Lately, I want to emphasize this, the EU itself, following the Iranian example, when they want to try to build their own military force now, they're trying to build their own economies, they're trying to show themselves as independent from the American
government. Right, Saib, allow me to jump in there for the sake of time. Because you mentioned the achievements, the scientific achievements of the country, I wanted to actually ask you about that. It's a question for both of you. First, Saib, please go on, because you were already talking about it. Despite all the sanctions and the cruel, illegal sanctions that Iran is on, that basically the entire life of the Islamic Republic, it has been under sanctions, but we are seeing so much progress in science, in the nuclear industry. We can see how Iran has progressed despite all the assassinations, all the plots to delay the progress and everything. What does that tell the world? What kind of message does it send across?
The message is very clear. The leadership of the Islamic Revolution was able from the beginning to guide the Iranian people toward building capable, independent state, politically and economically. And then they start achieving their scientific development. This development is indigenous in Iran, become localized from industry. Progress in various fields, you're talking about even apart from the sanctions and the wars and the aggression and the sabotage and all of these destabilizing operation, covert or overt operation, the revolution, Islamic revolution, opened the way to the country to develop itself and build solid scientific and industrial base that was advanced. You know, in nanotechnology, Iran is one of the leading countries of that base and have with its research centers. Iran today, while it's facing the imperialist powers who is wanting to do a regime change just to keep looting the country after that, is a strong, capable, independent country who can stand firm against imperialism and against the terrorist and assassination operation. Because the United States of America and Israel sending squads of death squads to assassinate scientists in different fields.
Right,
this is how they try to destabilize the country.
Thank you, sir. And John, one final question. Of course, I wanted you to also talk about the same question, but Iran has maintained its influence in regional politics and diplomacy despite all the efforts by the adversaries. 1 minute we have. Please, your take on that.
Well, again, they have extraordinary integrity, and they've kept their word with partners. Their diplomatic corps is renowned for its intelligence and again, its integrity. Yes, under sanctions, they have managed to prosper and achieve enormous things, but this is much like Cuba, like Venezuela. Cuba has been under sanctions since their revolution, and yet they produce more doctors than anywhere in the world. Iran is the same kind of story.
Right.
They have not squandered their role in the region. They have supported Hamas. They have supported the right side of everything. They are friends with the right people. It's just very sound and intelligent leadership, I think, and it's not the kind of cuckoos that we see, sadly, in power in the EU and US right now, let alone, of course, Israel.
Thank you so much, gentlemen, for the conversation. It was a great honor to have you on the program. Saeb Shaath, author and commentator, joining us from Belfast, UK, and John Stepling, author and commentator, joining us from Inderøy, Norway. And thank you so much for staying with us on Spotlight.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Why there is a need for a government which will be established by the Wali of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
In one of the letters that he writes to Sheikh Mufid, he tells us one of the ways that we can end the ghibah.
Let us see how one can prepare for the advent of the zuhur of Imam Mahdi, Sahib al-Zaman.
This is Dialogue, an introduction to the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam al-Mahdi, alayhi salam. A Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the history of Islam, Imam al-Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. Please stay tuned. The 12th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, is the one who brings hope to all of humanity. As the world is being grinded between the oppressors and tyrants of the age, we look towards the heavens so that the advent of the 12th divinely appointed Imam comes sooner. We raise our hands in prayers and we raise our hands in supplications, so that the awaited Savior of humanity comes and brings the final hope and salvation that humanity is so yearning for and desiring. The sights and the eyes of the world are looking towards the advent of this great Savior, Imam al-Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance so that his eminence comes to establish the divine rule of the Almighty Allah for every single human being is completely dependent and needs this divine rule of the Almighty Allah. And it is this divine rule of the Almighty Allah, the kingdom of God, that is to be established by Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, which will bring about ultimate justice in a world which is filled with cruelty and injustice. Welcome back. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about this dialogue between Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, and one of his close companions by the name of Uthman ibn Sa'id. We went through the whole conversation, and we are now, by the grace of Allah, at the last sentences of this dialogue. And so we find that Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, he says that the people should know that the truth is by us and with us, and no one except us, the 12 imams, would claim that they are an imam, but that he or she would be a liar or a fabricator. None except us, the 12 divinely appointed imams, can claim thus, except that he or she be deviated. Therefore, what we have stated here should suffice for the people, rather than seeking further clarifications. Rather than desiring more explanation and details, the people should rest content with this much, if Allah wills. And so here is the end of this long dialogue that was conducted and happened and occurred between Uthman ibn Sa'id and Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. And so here, of course, at the end of this conversation and dialogue, we find that, of course, Imam al-Mahdi is making it clear that there is no other Imam other than this 12th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. And his, as His Eminence himself said, that he will bring forth clear signs and he will put forth truth in the most beautiful form, and there will be luminous signs that he will bring, and these beautiful evidences that he will bring to prove him being the 12th divinely appointed Imam. And so on the other hand, you know, over the course of history and perhaps even into the future, we will find that there will be false Mahdis, as there have been false Mahdis in the past. And so we have to be very careful. Again, Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, is giving us a forewarning. He is telling us that the people that claim to have this position or status are liars, they are fabricators, they are deviated, and that it is enough that we have these signs, or we know the signs, and we think clearly so that we are able to distinguish between right and wrong. And of course, we shouldn't be fooled by the false and fabricated lies and corruptions and deviations, excuse me, of these false messiahs and these false Mahdis. And of course, the closer we get